All right. So welcome to the OFX podcast. I'm doing the introduction today. Bethany McChesney here, along with my co-host, Dave Claxton. I did not think of a clever alliteration for his name. Sorry.
You kind of let me down.
You put me on the spot. and today we have our guest, Dr. Sasha Gaulish. So Sasha is a, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of these, but so you're a professor of engineering at the University of Toronto.
I was a professor of engineering. I now actually work in the Faculty of Kinesiology on a really cool project looking at kids in sport. So I'm not a professor kind of any, yeah, we'll leave that in.
So your PhD though is in engineering.
My PhD is in fact in engineering. Yeah, I'm a super nerd. You're not wrong.
Yeah, that's true. So Sasha is also, she's an elite distance runner. She has dabbled in mountain running as well. So you may have recognized her name from the Mountain Running World Championships. I'm not going to list your accolades because I will be here for too long with the introduction, but Sasha has a world record in the indoor mile for 40 plus women and many Canadian masters records. You are, if you don't mind me saying your age, you're 42. 41?
Yep. 42. Yeah.
42.
Yeah.
So Sasha and I actually know each other from way back. 20 years ago, back when we were collegiate runners at the University of Western, which is where you got your undergrad in engineering. And I was a wee pup in my undergrad in kinesiology. So we met way back on the cross country team. It was your second degree, though.
It was my second degree.
Yeah. So Sasha,
I have a gap degree. Some people go on like a gap year vacation. I took a gap degree.
In like your first degree, economics, was it?
Yeah. So I was in commerce at U of T, decided I never wanted to be a banker. I love math and science. So that's why I ended up. And Western has many strong faculties, but their faculty of engineering and undergraduate education is very strong. And I not only had a lot of fun there, but learned a lot.
Yeah. So Sasha was a mentor for me a little bit when I started running also at university, because again, I was very much a rookie in the world of competitive distance running, and she very much had her feet wet. So I appreciated her mentorship when I started in the distance running world. So way, way back. So, and we've kind of maintained contact a little bit, which is kind of cool. And, you know, following each other also in our journey. So the interesting thing about Sasha is she stepped away from the running world for a good chunk of time, came back in your 30s and started tearing things up again, which is always interesting too, because again, like in our world of hybrid racing and OCR, a lot of athletes are coming into it after another sport career that kind of took a dive, or, you know, they needed to shift because of different reasons. So we do have a lot of people that are kind of coming into it in a competitive side, even in their 30s or even in their 40s or beyond. So we do have that type of population as well in the hybrid racing scene. So maybe just share a little bit then what brought you back to running.
I mean, I was working too much. So I had this awesome engineering consulting job. I was working in roadside construction with this incredible team, but like we worked long hours, right? Like construction is just long hours. You go back to the office and, you know, friends had said to me, like, can we miss you? Like, can you please come back to running? And I, so, you know, I actually would run while at the office. So if I got a complicated math or engineering problem, I'd be like, hey, I'm just going to put my stuff on. I need to step away from this problem and kind of like go run on the trails, connect with nature and solve it. So I was always active. I just wasn't competing. But my friends were like, listen, you are, you know, you're a hermit on the weekends. Could you think about coming back to practice? And so I negotiated with the people I was working with that I could leave early Monday and Thursday, which is like, if you run in Toronto, you're like, oh, those are the days everybody works out. So that I could meet up with the team again. And so it was really for social reasons at first, yes, through activity. But that was like my sneaky way back in, I guess, was really finding my sense of belonging again with my girlfriends, and then meeting other elite runners and wondering sort of as I was dipping my toe in, as I got faster, like, do I get to play the what if game? Like, am I actually going to be this like anomaly that gets to play what if? And I did.
Yeah,
So
and sorry, go ahead.
define the what if game here, just so that we're a little clear.
Sure. So, okay, so I stole this from Brad Stolberg. So Brad Stolberg has written a bunch of books, but in one of his episodes with Steve Magnus, he was talking about like, yeah, I wonder if what if what had happened if I didn't burn out when I was, going from high school to college with, and I can't remember the coaching situation, like it was a toxic coaching situation that he quit, but he quit. And like Brad's a really good athlete. It's like, well, I wonder what could have happened. And in a sense, I got to play that game, right? Like I really stepped away from high performance athletics, right? It for a whole host of reasons. But then I got to kind of dip my toe back in and play the what if game. Like I wonder what might happen. And the courage to do that, to be like, I'm on this path that is this traditional path that we're supposed to take. Supposed to, quotation marks, right? Go to school, get a degree or two, right? Find a partner, have kids, don't have kids, get a career, move through your career, move up the corporate ladder. And I mean, for sure, I've never fit like in a box. I've never really followed a traditional path. And when, I sort of got the confidence, and really for my mom to say, go play the what if game, quit your job, go try running because you'll never get this opportunity again in life. I really seized the, okay, let's go play this what if game. And I like, maybe that should be the title of a book I write one day, like go play the what if game, like whatever the what if game is to you, right? The worst that happens is you have a lot of fun along the way. You meet some really interesting people and you connect. You may not reach the pinnacle of where you wanted to get to, but I promise along the way that there's this adventure. And so, how do we play more of that what if game and getting off that like the railroad of the stereotype life?
I like it.
So, and then you
Sorry, I
went
was
back
like,
and
perfect.
you ran varsity again, right? You had
I actually ran
LT.
varsity 3 times at U of T. So I technically went back when I was doing my master's, when I was working at the Ministry of Transportation of Ontario. I was taking 3 courses, so technically I was eligible working full time. So my running was not fabulous, like something had to give. And then I did go back again in 2015 to pursue my PhD alongside running.
And so in 2023, you also were named to our Canadian team. You ran at the Marathon World Championships. So Sasha, one of the craziest things about Sasha is her range. So from the 1500 meter on the track to the marathon, so she can kind of do it all, which is also really impressive. So you name it, and she
Thanks.
probably has a championship in it. So it's very impressive. I
So
think, was it 2022 that we called the year of Sasha Gaulish?
that was the year 2022 was the year of Sasha Gaulish. I actually ran all of the Canadian championships. Okay, so Beth, here's another like tidbit. I actually really love the 600 indoors. So like, yes, I love the 1500, but did you ever run a 600 indoors?
No. I once had to
Okay.
do at the end of a 4x4 because someone was
Yeah.
injured, and that's what you do with the distance runners, and it was so painful.
Oh yeah, it is. So and I would come at it very much from a distance side. So it would almost be like I wasn't in the race going through the first 200. But there was something, one, there's something super satisfying about running on the indoor track. Just it's short, laps go by really quickly. It feels really fast. And so the 600 feels really fast. And so I'm one of the few people that would negative split. And there was just something so satisfying about passing like everybody that you could in that last 200 meters. And I think regardless of what race avenue, right? Like OCR, marathon, short distance, like there's something pretty empowering when you have that sort of like second wind, like guttural strength to like come through and do something, right? And like the confidence it gives you to like try other things while you're racing and even like trust yourself to try doing something outside of the sport that you're doing.
It's like being on the hunt.
It's like, yeah, but like, but trusting that you're on a hunt where you're not going to fall prey, right? And that's such a different feeling, right? Like that ability to trust yourself. And for sure, like you have to fail to get there, right? Like it's not this like linear path of like, oh, it feels so good all the time and it works out all the time, right? Like this isn't a fairy tale, that this is reality, right? And but understand, you have to understand your failure boundaries so that you can actually approach them so that you can actually then build this like trust and confidence that you have in yourself to like go out and be able to do things and not fall prey to the things around you, especially the things that are out of your control, right? Like, I think weather and climate change are things that we're all going to come up against when we're racing in the future. And like, that's something we can't control. And so, like, those are the things, like, don't fall prey to that, right? Like, for me, I get really cold. It would be like, put the right clothes on so that if it's raining and cold, you don't freeze so that you can't race.
Yeah, it's like the show up and blow up. Sometimes you have to really push that line and see like where can I actually go until I actually blow up? And that's kind of what you would do in that second half.
Oh, in the 600, you blow up no matter what. I don't care who you are. You blow up in the 600. It just depends on how close to the finish line it happens.
Just get as close as possible.
Yeah, as possible.
Yeah, so that's a little bit about Sasha's accomplishments. But the reason that we have Sasha on, and the reason I even mentioned her age, because I would never normally do that, is Sasha is a very big advocate right now for just reducing the stigmas around perimenopause. And if you don't follow Sasha yet on social media, I find your reels incredibly entertaining and hilarious.
Thank
And
you.
just kind of speaking about the things again that women don't talk about, and as athletes too, because we're so fine-tuned and we're so into all like everything that happens within our body, and it affects us sometimes on a deeper level because we expect so much out of our bodies. When these changes start to happen, it can be met with a lot of frustration, and also, as I'm realizing, more and more misinformation or complete lack of information. And so that's really the biggest reason I wanted to bring you on, because you, again, you know your stuff, you're in it right now, and you and a couple other people, if you follow Camille Heron, she talks a lot about it as well. And just and again, a high performance athlete, still out there rocking it, but she's dealing again with perimenopause and the things. And it's again, it's not the end of your athletic life. It's just we learn and we shift. And the more that we can talk about this and learn from each other and our own experiences, the more we can help and help women to continue to compete through this and beyond. And also, I'm going to preface this with also saying Sasha is not a doctor of medicine, so we're speaking from her experience and what she has learned, which I mean, in this day and age, anyways, people listen very flippantly to a lot of people's misinformation all the time on social media. So understand we are very educated in this to the degree that we are from personal experience and our own knowledge just from research and everything that you have done. So that's kind of where we're coming at it. Not medical doctors, but you know, we're gonna share Sasha's experience and what she's learned. So, Sasha. We did have a lot of questions, but we'll just talk first about what would be then the difference. So some people might have not even really ever heard what perimenopause is, just menopause. So what then would be the difference, the defining difference between perimenopause and menopause?
Okay, so a couple just to go back. So it's destigmatizing not just perimenopause, but like all the things that come with like generalizing here, being a woman, right? Like those of us with a menstrual cycle. And so I didn't know that perimenopause was a whole phase of the menstrual cycle life cycle, right? And so perimenopause kind of happens in this phase before menopause. And so roughly speaking, it's about 10 years before you hit menopause. So what's very interesting is we talk about menopause as a phase. Menopause is a moment in time. Menopause is the moment that you lose your period and you then enter postmenopause, right? So we talk about menopause like it's this phase, but it's a moment in time. And so perimenopause is the other side of that moment in time that's menopause before postmenopause. And it's a little bit where things go off the rails in a sense, right? So if we think about either biology class or health and physical education, depending on where you grew up and where you went to school, right? We talked about puberty and generalized, we say that when girls go through puberty, they get their menstrual cycle and it's a period. And approximately every 28 days, which is really actually every 21 to 42, and 28 is not the average of those two numbers, just so we're clear. Every 28 days, you're going to have a bleed. There's sort of like four phases, like the post phase, the peak of your hormones, then leading back into your bleed and your bleed. And then you repeat that till you get pregnant, and then it returns to normal after you get pregnant. And then one day you stop getting your period. It is not that simple at all. Bethany, you have three children?
Two.
Okay. Anyways, you have multiple children, right? Your period did not return to like, oh, it's what it's like out of a textbook. And so in this conversation, what we don't talk about at all is this phase that as you get older and you approach menopause, things change. And it's really that your hormones are changing that's causing all of these other changes. And it's related to, the number of eggs that you are producing and that are falling, which is what affects the hormones and the hormone curve through your cycle.
So and there's some misconceptions too around menopause as it's defined, and people often just think menopause is when you start getting hot flashes. And the interesting thing too about the whole pre and perimenopause phases is like a lot of women, their symptoms are so different. And when you're defining what it means to be in perimenopause, we have like 50 to 70 different symptoms that could all fall into that. Because our hormones, the endocrine system is in charge of so much, from like weight, your gut, your mood, your like insulin, like all these, the way you digest food, like all there's it's in charge of so many things, your body temperature control. So there's so many different symptoms. Some women might not ever even have hot flashes. So we kind of put these labels on it that it can really be completely false. So a lot of times women have started perimenopause and they don't even necessarily know it, because they're more tired than they used to be. They're not recovering the same, and they would never necessarily connect that with being in a menopausal state, or they have a major life change. And so maybe their mood is different, but you can kind of chalk it up to, the job change, the mood, ch the house move, the marital breakdown, whatever. But some of it is related to the hormone shifts that are happening during perimenopause as well. So there's so many misconceptions around that.
One of the things too, actually, that I would be remiss to not say is, particularly with perimenopause and athletes, right? And I just want to say, like, yes, I perform at like one of the highest levels, but so many people perform at a really high level as well. And so one of the other challenges with perimenopause is many of the symptoms look like REDS. So if you look at the new update to the REDS Cat 2 tool, and you look at the health effects of what RED-S, so relative energy deficiency syndrome, because in sport, sorry, relative energy deficiency syndrome in sport, because acronyms are fun, but you need to tell people what they mean. So many of the symptoms sort of mirror what RED-S, right? This like low energy availability might look like. And one of the challenges when you're going through perimenopause is, and I think this is one of the questions you want to ask me, is around weight gain. And so if you're going into low energy availability because you're trying to manipulate your weight in a certain way, you may actually have both perimenopause and REDS. And so trying to untangle the two can be really challenging. And so it's really important as an athlete to have, a team that you work with, and that could be doctor, naturopath, chiropractor. Like, there's all these amazing people working out there that really understand sport and nutrition from a holistic perspective, so that, you could be both in REDS and perimenopause, but you may also just be in REDS, or you may be in perimenopause.
So then for yourself, what were your first symptoms that led you down the road of trying to figure out what it was and eventually figuring out you were in perimenopause?
So I didn't, when I went into perimenopause, I had no idea that perimenopause was a thing, right? So I'm a little bit older than you, but I really grew up in a time where you didn't talk about periods and you didn't talk about what was going on. And I was the ultimate tomboy, which is a word I'm not sure you're supposed to use anymore, but I was a tomboy in that time. So I'm using that word. So all of that period product was hidden. And I never talked about it. And I just like, it was part of my life that happened, but I didn't talk about it. And I didn't talk about it with anybody. And so I think I went into perimenopause somewhere around the time that I was about 36 years old. My periods really started to change. I got really heavy bleeding and I got really bad cramping. And for my entire life, I had really low bleeding and no cramping. So like that should have been an alarm bell, but I was just like, well, I guess this is just different and that's what this is. But what that actually is signaling is your body can no longer produce the amount of estrogen that it needs. And so to do that, it's releasing more eggs, which causes a heavier bleed, thicker lining, et cetera. And so though that was, looking back, one of the main symptoms. What sort of like pushed me over the edge and the precipice was, I was achy all the time, like my knees and my feet. It's probably similar to what arthritis pain is like, when you have it in a really like dull, consistent way. So like 2 out of 10 pain, but all the time. And Advil, like ibuprofen wouldn't control it. Tylenol wouldn't kind of like take care of the pain. Like it was just very uncomfortable. And my muscles didn't feel like they were working for me. So my muscles kind of felt like this like sack of mashed potatoes in a burlap sack. And so you're like, I know that when I'm running, they're supposed to contract. So my feet and my knees hurt and my muscles are not working for me. And then on dry skin, oh my gosh, my skin would just like flake off my arms. And I was like, I'm literally rubbing coconut oil into my skin. Like, this should be absorbing, and I have a dog who was like, oh, you're rubbing coconut oil? I'm just, let me lick you. And I'm like, no. If you lick it off, this isn't going to do what I need it to do. So like, anyways. So those were some of my major symptoms. Wait, no, that's not true. Brain fog was a good one where I was like, I don't remember what I was supposed to be doing. And I also have this crazy imposter syndrome as I'm sitting at my computer. I'm going to sit here with my hands on my keyboard and do nothing because I'm so debilitated by my imposter syndrome that I can't even write an email.
Yeah, so like all of those things too, some people just kind of chalk that up to normal, or and I find the brain fog thing is so common also, and people just say, oh, I'm getting older, yeah, there's and then the first thing that you do when you go to the doctor and you're saying my periods are heavy, typically then from my client's experience also, you get put on birth control pills to control it.
And so I use a hormonal IUD, right? So I'm on not no I'm on the Kylina, not the other one. So the one that's like a slightly lower dose of progesterone. And so again, not a doctor, not an expert, but there is evidence that when you can get your progesterone regulated, if your body's able to, it will then continue to produce estrogen. And so it regulates the flow. Right. So most people go on an IUD because they're like, oh, this is fantastic birth control and I'm never going to get a bleed. And I'm like, yeah, that actually is winning. There's no question about it. Like, they're like having your period just like kind of sucks, especially as an athlete. You're like, this just sucks. But anyways, having an IUD can be really helpful. I need to say that a copper IUD is the opposite of that. And so if you go into the off into your doctor's office and they offer you a copper IUD, just be well aware that yes, the hormones may do the same things, but the bleed will not at all be the same, which I think is a misconception. Gwen Jorgensen has a couple podcasts where she is fabulously hilarious about it. I'll leave it to her to explain. But you need to be on a hormonal IUD if you're in perimenopause and you're looking for some of those hormonal replacement therapy techniques.
Yeah, so that was actually so maybe okay, before I get into hormone replacement therapy techniques, when so how then did you end up getting diagnosed or figuring out that you were in perimenopause?
I think I kind of posted some stuff. So I think two things. I posted some stuff on Instagram. I was like, why do I feel this way? And someone who's a family physician that I know in the US who I used to run with was like, I think you're in perimenopause, which immediately was like, hello, Google machine, what is perimenopause? And I was like, oh, hello. Yes, I am. I mean, I just didn't know that it really existed. So that was probably somewhere around when I was 40. So like for 4 years, I would say I was suffering, but there were definitely like symptoms that I was unaware of, and I wish I had known earlier what this was. I wonder if it would have changed some of the trajectory of my career. I don't think so. I think I've accomplished amazing things. I still have a few what ifs. I think we'll always all have some what ifs. But just in terms of like overall life contentedness, I think knowing earlier it would have been really helpful. So like we talked about this isn't on the recording, so I'll mention now, like I'm injured, right? And I haven't run for 4 months and I miss it. And even though I was running then, there was this like loss of competency, of feeling like a master in my own body at the time that I craved, right? Like, regardless of what level of runner you're at, you reach your own level of mastery. And when you lose that, it's really hard. And so I was able to get that back, but I like really fell off this precipice of not being able to do the thing that I loved the most.
Did you ever get your hormones tested?
I did. So I was initially working with Inside Tracker when Inside Tracker would send me free blood tests, and they are fabulous and an incredible complement of tests. So getting your hormones tested, I think, is really important. As you are sort of like figuring out where you're at, probably every quarter, right? To see, I mean, you might see that your levels are low, but to see if they're declining, specifically estrogen and progesterone, let me be clear in terms of like hormones. DHEA, which I can't remember what the acronym is for. And there's one other one. You also want to be watching your this the not gonna it'll come to me. Anyways,
TSH,
probably.
thyroid stimulating hormone.
That would be exactly what it is. Yes, thank you. But I then went to see my family doctor who he was pretty funny. So he's like, listen, I don't think you're in perimenopause, but I want to hear all of your symptoms. And he let me go through everything. Like, I think I spoke to him for 30 minutes. Most people, when they go to their doctor's office, get 7 seconds before their doctor cuts them off. My doctor didn't cut me off, but he would ask me questions. Tell me about this. Tell me about this. And so we've done my blood work sort of in 6 month increments now, and he's been fantastic. I know that it is not the case. And actually, at the end of the 30 minutes, he was like, I'm pretty sure you're in perimenopause. Let's get your blood work done. It's been about 4 months. I'd love to see where you're at again. And he's been fantastic. And so I think as women, right, like we're still under this like marginalization of like being really careful about what we ask for and what we advocate for. And it's really important to advocate for your health. And so going into your doctor's office and framing it as these are my symptoms. I'm not playing Dr. Google. I do know that these are symptoms of perimenopause. I would like to have my hormones tested. And if you get pushback, I think you need to say to your doctor, you know, like, please tell me why you won't do this. And if they say because you're too young to be in perimenopause or XYZ, that doesn't make sense, you're allowed to push back. Yes, they are an expert. But one of the challenges that we know, and this is like not necessarily a criticism of the medical system, but like just an awareness, like both my parents are doctors. I think the medical system does amazing things. But like female reproductive, like other than delivering babies, really isn't part of training, particularly for family doctors. And family doctors are expected to know an inordinate amount of information. And so you know, advocating for yourself. There are more and more family doctors and more OBGYNs who are talking about these things, so that you should get your hormone levels tested. And like even post-pregnancy, right? Like there's a lot of challenges that happen with pregnancy and post-pregnancy. Like getting your values tested probably, okay, I haven't had a baby, so I can't answer this question, but probably in the 3 to 6 month range after, if you're really looking to be active, you probably want to know where your hormones are at. So that you don't hurt yourself.
So, and when you're getting your hormones tested, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is what I have heard, you want to do it on day five of your cycle.
Yes, when you're do it when you're in the luteal phase. So here's what's it, this will vary, right? So I think you basically want to do it 3 to 4 days after your bleed, right? So if you bleed longer, which is normal, or you bleed shorter, which is normal, right? You want to make sure that you're out of that bleed phase. Inside Tracker and Whoop have done an incredible job at providing that information online for people. So Fitter is the app that I use to track my period. So make sure you're tracking your period so you can actually get your blood tested at the right time.
Yeah. What about for people that don't have a period?
It depends on why, right? And
Yeah.
so, if you're on birth control, you actually will know exactly what that day is, right? Because you have a steady state of hormone release. If you have an IUD, what you need to do is start tracking your symptoms. Dr. Stacey Sims does a lot of good work around this, and another one does as well. But basically, download a period app, right? So Fitter or can't remember Stacey Sims, Roar, and start tracking your symptoms. And all of a sudden, you'll actually be able to see where you are in your cycle. But because you have an IUD, you are going to have a little bit more normality to your cycle. But there are, IUD or not, there's some pretty definitive cycles as to where the egg release happens at the top of the cycle. So you can figure it out on either side.
Yeah, even taking like your morning body temperature, you can see a little spike. So this is if you're checking, getting your blood work and your hormones tested, again, your estrogen and progesterone are the ones that you're looking at. So it's really important also to understand then what estrogen does. So I did write out a list of what estrogen is primarily. What its jobs are. And again, it does many, many things in our system. But if these things are, you're starting to notice a change in them, get your hormones checked to see if maybe your estrogen levels are dropping. So when estrogen levels start to drop in your system, you do notice a decrease in muscle tissue. So you don't maintain it as well. Mitochondrial function, so your endurance might be affected. It affects inflammation, your blood sugars, it regulates your appetite. Mood regulation, so maybe you're not able to self-regulate as well. Emotionally, it controls cortisol, which is your stress hormone. So you might be finding you're waking up in the middle of the night, racing thoughts, you're too anxious for things that you would normally not be. It controls body temperature. So you get really cold or you get really hot and you have a hard time transitioning out of that. It controls your blood pressure. It maintains and builds bone. And it maintains your vaginal lining. So all things, so again, that's a huge range of things. And as it starts to drop, it affects different people differently within that range of things that it does. And then progesterone helps to
So
counterbalance
hang on, just
all the
stop there
things.
for a sec. I just want to stop you there for a sec. So guys, here I'm talking to you. So estrogen is the female sex hormone. Testosterone is the male sex hormone. So if you're a guy listening to this, like, what would it be like for me? It would be like your testosterone, not only is it tank, but just picture it like dipping and like waving all around and imagine being like, oh, all those things, like your appetite, your stress level, your sleep, just like generally how you feel, your muscle tone, like all of that in flux, right? It would be based on changing testosterone. So now we'll go back to progesterone. So I just wanted the guys to feel welcome today.
Well, and it is good too. And Dave can chime in later, but ways to support someone in going through perimenopause. So yeah, then progesterone helps to balance out a lot of these the negative sides of the lowering of estrogen. So you want these things to be in balance. So progesterone, particularly as it lowers, that would be the one where if you're finding that you're particularly like the cortisol in your racing mind at night, it helps with the calming effects of things. So progesterone, if you're finding you don't calm down well at night. So that's kind of just a completely broad stroke of what lowering estrogen does affect. So within that then, so let's get to some questions that people have given, and if we haven't talked on them yet. Okay, so when do you go through phases where you struggle and then you're feeling good and you kind of go back and forth?
I for sure did. Now that I'm on some consistent hormone therapy, I don't. I think the other thing, I just want to go back for a second to say, testosterone. So women also have testosterone, right? Like our dominant sex steroid is estrogen, but we also have testosterone. And so it's really important that you get your testosterone checked. Some women going through perimenopause, it just kind of stays the same. Some get a little bit of an elevation, and some for some women, it tanks. And when it tanks, all like just imagine like it would be even worse. So like mine's pretty steady, which has been great, but I've heard for women who've had like testosterone that's tanked, it is just like a whirlwind of awfulness.
So, and when we forgot to go back to hormone replacement therapy, but hormone replacement therapy again, it you could be replacing testosterone as well for women, testosterone, progesterone, or estrogen. And it's kind of a symptom-based thing. And from everything that I've heard, it's a little bit of a guessing game. You can test your hormones, but based on as far as what your symptoms are, it's a bit of a guessing game. So, and then with hormone replacement therapy, there's different ways to get it. Sometimes it's oral, sometimes it's injections, sometimes it's creams, sometimes it's patches.
And then I also would add in terms of hormone replacement therapy. So Dr. Mary Claire on Instagram is a physician in the US. She is trained in this. She has awesome information. Highly recommend everybody follow her. I have no affiliation with this woman. She's also pretty funny, which is great. And also Dr. Stacey Sims. So like ashwagandha is another, it's not a hormone replacement therapy,
It's an
but it's
adaptogen.
got, yeah, it's an adaptogen and it's got known effects of like helping with cortisol, right? And so along with like, quotation marks, typical hormone replacement therapy, they recommend that women in perimenopause take ashwagandha in the morning, which I also do. And so to me, it's like part of the hormone replacement therapy because in a sense, it's managing my cortisol. So one of the other things, so I am like, I love getting up early in the morning and doing work. Like it just like get a workout done, crush work, feels so good. But my cortisol spike from that can be unbelievable. So that by noon I'm like so anxious. And so I found that taking ashwagandha in terms of like managing my hormones just sort of like mitigates that cortisol spike so that I still get the same amount of work done, but that I don't a end up in that anxiety spiral later in the day.
So ashwagandha, it's like it's a plant, so there wouldn't be negative side effects to it. So if it's something anybody could really take it anyway. So it does negate the effects of high cortisol. So it helps your body's stress systems to calm down. So, and it also even digestion, which can be affected by stress, and again, your temperature and your immune system. So it's a good one if you ever wanted to look into something to add to your supplement repertoire. There's no real negative side effects. The thing with adaptogens, though, is so they do, again, they build in your system, so it takes a bit, and then you would want to cycle off of them every 6 to 8 weeks for 3 to 4 days, so you don't build a tolerance to them. So, and it just has to be 3 to 4 days, and then you could go back on it. So the ashwagandha is probably the main one, and then in Stacey Sims' book, so her new one, she listed some other ones: holy basil, rhodiola, which is good for cognition. So I do take that one as well. Schizandra for mental, for concentration as well, and then maca, so which is also specifically supports the sex hormones. So we've probably heard about that too. It's in drinks a lot of times too now. So yeah. So those are, that's adapted. Yeah. So that's another thing that you could take outside of getting into hormone replacement therapy.
I have a quick question about the hormone replacement therapy, and if this is an uneducated question, it is.
No question is uneducated because everybody's uneducated because there's been no education on this. So you're
You haven't hung around me long enough. Believe me, I've got stupid questions. So when it comes to like a hormone replacement therapy, and you say testosterone up and down, spiking, going over the place, possibly tanking, as a high level elite athlete, where obviously that can be a problem in testing for performance enhancing drugs, does that become a slippery slope and hard to navigate?
Yes and no. So it shouldn't, right? Like this is a normal part of female development. And so I think one of the things we have to remember is the sports system was primarily set up for males, right? I don't need to go in the history of that. It is set up for males. Last year in 2023, I believe this individual is named Cal Kalamea. I cannot remember what their pronouns are. So to be politically correct, I'm going to say they for now. Kyle Kalamea is a transgender man and was given a TUE to take testosterone for hormone support to become a man. And so I think we've opened the door to say that the way that things work for females is a little bit different. And so Kyle Kalamea is subjected to much more anti-doping testing, I believe, to stay, and I believe they have to stay within the range that is considered, quotation marks, normal for a female, which is less than 2.5 nanomoles per milliliter, liter. Okay, I can't remember the exact, doesn't matter. It would require a little bit more work, but I think that those are conversations that need to happen because these are normal things that happen. I think if someone is going to use testosterone in a negative, deleterious, performance advantage way, I think they're going to do it anyways. And so I don't think we need to be writing policy for the people who just want to perform and live who they are. And I'm not even sure that the policy is going to stop people from doing it. So that's a whole other topic we could talk about another day. But it's a really important thing to talk about. And I think that, you know, WADA really is like linked to the IOC, and then it is up to the various countries and organizations. But I think we're going to see a shift in, and I hope we see a shift in this, because otherwise we're narrowly defining what it is to be a woman to compete in this like very narrow box when it's a little bit wider than that. And you know, with women's hormones doing this, you know, we need to be a little bit more sensitive to how we deal with things. And it's okay to say that there are differences between males and females. And so, you know, how one might get a TUE might be a little bit different for a female. Not a dumb question.
Well, I'll come up with one. Give me time.
I can come up with one too. We're in good company.
Yeah, it's interesting because our sport is just kind of starting to write some of the rules around PEDs. So it's been a little bit more of a discussion recently. So it's interesting also to see the way that it all kind of plays out with when, you know, people are taking things for just health reasons also that are on
Yeah.
this. And I mean, again, that's a whole podcast in itself when we're talking about PEDs. So, going back to some of so the questions. So I when it comes to people that my clients and what they struggle with, the biggest question that and their frustration is the gain weight during this time. And
Yeah.
what can we do to counteract the effects of that? Why does that happen? And what should their training look like? And that this is like a five-part question. So, but yeah, the training and then nutrition, that all kind of goes together. So the weight gain part during perimenopause, and then what do they do about it from your perspective?
So the menopause is, right, the tire that you develop around your waist is actually your body just trying to produce estrogen, right? So estrogen is a sex-based hormone, but it's a fat-based hormone. And so to produce estrogen, it needs fat. And so basically what it's doing to produce estrogen is it's layering on fat so that it can produce more estrogen so that your body can function. And so if you start to sort of notice that, one thing to sort of be aware is diet isn't going to help you. There is nothing in your nutrition that you can do to stop that from happening. And actually the research on low energy availability, particularly in females, as you start to like have a negative energy balance, right? And a prolonged negative energy balance, you're really going to start to gain weight around your middle because it's trying to produce even more estrogen to keep up with state of life things. So if when you start to notice that, one, just remember there's probably not much that you can do with your diet. Really good time to go see your doctor to get your hormones tested to see if you need either an estrogen building block or to take estrogen itself. Around diet, I'm not an expert. I would say that I think most of the world probably doesn't eat, well, most of the female world, I should say, doesn't need enough protein. And so during this time, as you're going through this like repair, right? So how you have to really be conscious of like how much fuel you need going into your workout, but you actually need to be way more conscious about the protein and the fat, right? Because we need fat. for some pretty critical repair things along with the protein to recover from the workouts that we're doing. And so we know that typically women don't eat enough protein during their days. And so how can you add protein supplementation? Like for me, it's literally adding protein supplements because I just get tired of eating food. And there are some pretty delicious protein supplements out there, so why not? So really thinking about protein supplementation and eating those good fats. So like the olive oils, the avocados, the nuts, the seeds, right? Like the whole food fats. And then really being thoughtful about what kind of carbohydrates and fuel you're putting in your body. So like I could pretty much eat anything, candy, cake, et cetera. And like those days are gone, right? Like my metabolism has changed a bit. That doesn't mean that I don't eat sweets and treats at times, but I'm just a little bit more thoughtful. And I was pretty thoughtful about my diet overall, but I'm even more thoughtful about what types of carbohydrates I'm putting in my body, knowing how like highly processed carbohydrates aren't really used in your body all that well and can just be stored as fat if it's like, I don't need this as fuel right now.
So speaking on the nutrition part, I'm just going to reiterate what Mary Claire, who you mentioned her previously as well, a doctor, what she recommends. So the two biggest things that you want to start with is one, make sure you get enough protein. So with my clients, I usually say 1 gram of protein per pound that you would weigh. So it's a rough calculation, but essentially, so if you are a 130-pound female, try to get 130 grams of protein. And then the second thing is fiber. So a lot of people super under consume fiber. And so again, that number that you're aiming for is about 30 grams a day. Most women get about 10. And the reason for fiber is that so it helps to stabilize your insulin. And again, with lowering estrogen levels, which affects again your insulin sensitivity. So then fiber will help to counteract that. It also helps your gut microbiome. And as we're starting to learn more about the gut microbiome and its effect on the brain and mood, because our neurotransmitters are actually being produced in your gut. So the healthier you can help the gut microbiome, the healthier you are overall. And so fiber was her number two. So protein and fiber. And then outside of that, just the supplements that she recommended were so vitamin D, which is also a precursor for some of our hormones, vitamin D with K2, and then creatine. So I don't know if you take creatine, but it is also something I recommend to my clients. But creatine, and again, there's a lot of misconceptions around it, based on when it first came out in the 90s, and people were hyperdosing with it and getting puffy. But creatine actually really helps with brain inflammation and also helps with maintaining your muscle tissue and bone tissue. And again, because that's something that women start to notice that they lose at an increasing rate, during menopause, so it helps with that. And just 5 grams a day, so it's just one scoop in your shake. And and so that would be the other supplement that was recommended. So just a quick what was recommended by the expert, that's what she said about that.
Yes, I take all of those things. Well, I don't take fiber, I eat fiber.
So, and a lot of people don't get enough fiber. So what I do, if you're like, okay, I don't really know, one trick that I recommend to my clients first is, so 2 tablespoons of chia seeds in a little bit of almond milk, soak it overnight, and you have 10 grams of fiber to start your day. So then you're already off on a good track. And then if you're eating leafy greens in the day, you're probably going to get pretty close. So it's not super complicated. You can get fiber supplements even that you put in your coffee. But anyways, so then that's the nutrition piece. So then what about training? Because this is another thing is, again, and I'm such a misconception also. People think, if I want to lose weight, I'm just going to start hammering away at cardio. And from, again, your experience and knowledge, what do women need to do as they're in the perimenopausal state and their hormones are starting to shift in regards to training?
I mean, Stacey Sims says it best, lift heavy shit, right? This idea that like you got to get your muscles to go to fatigue, right? And so like there is also a misconception that if you lift heavy things that you're going to like super bulk, right? You're not. If you're taking performance enhancing drugs, you might, but that's we're taking there's a whole let's just leave that. But this idea of muscle building, right, and getting your muscle to fatigue, right, and shifting. And I think, like, let's go to the queen of all of this. Let's talk about Camille Heron, who just set the 6-day record, right? Like, Camille Heron doesn't run for 8 hours a day to train for that event, right? She usually does, I think, sort of roughly 2 1 to 1.5 hour runs a day, which, if you're going into a 6-day record, is really not a ton of running. But she lifts, right? Like, you have to have muscle mass to actually get any gains from that endurance. I don't know your clients all that well, but one of the things, like, that I've seen in my coaching practice around, like, when you shift to a different modality. So as a runner, right, like, when people shift to the bike or the elliptical, they can't get their heart rate up, right? And so, you know, I'm doing cardio, but I'm on the elliptical and my heart rate's at 110. Like, it's not doing anything for you, right? Like, that's nice that you're probably on your phone too. So, like, you haven't even taken a brain break, right? So, I think the whole thing is, like, thinking about how you get your muscles to go into fatigue, right? And so you have to lift. And so you don't have to lift until, like, collapse, but you have to lift kind of like when you're training for any endurance events where your legs muscles get tired. Like, your muscles have to fatigue and get some tiredness in them. And to do that, you've got to lift something that's reasonably heavy. Heavy to me, to you, to di diff different, right? And as we progress through life, like, that is going to change as well, right? And being open and sensitive to that. But also, like, if you work a lot and you go to and you travel a lot for work and you end up in hotel gyms and, like, 15 to 20 pounds are all you can work with, make it work, right? Like, don't skip the workout and be like, oh, there's nothing, like, heavy here to lift. Do enough sets that are enough reps that you get to that fatigue, but then, like, make it a priority that other times when you go to the gym that you are lifting heavy things with fewer repetitions to get to that fatigue. And I promise you, it will actually just make you faster. I, like, lifted throughout my entire running career, and I absolutely swear by it. And, like, you go watch Femke Bol, Emma Bates, the steeplechaser. Like, there's all these world-class women on the running circuit in the middle distance, and they lift a ton. Just, it's amazing. I'm, like, kind of miss it because with my knee injury, I can't really lift the same way right now. So it's kind of sucks. But yeah, it's super important to maintain muscle mass and almost try to continue to, like, slightly micro tear to be building muscle mass, not in a, like, bulking way, but you're going to be losing some. So if you can build some, you stay at, like, it's net zero effect.
So one quick question about that, I guess. And one, I'm almost asking for a clarification. And so for some people, we've talked about this before. Those who are worried you're going to get too bulky from lifting heavy, you don't accidentally become jacked. It's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. It's not a stressor. Don't worry about that. But when you're saying to lift heavy shit, obviously you're not telling people you should go out and every day work out and shoot for a one rep max.
No, not at all.
So maybe just a little clarification on, like, what lift heavy shit would be like. You know, because I'm all
Sure.
in favor. I really like the idea of everyone lifting and
So we're still
getting their heart
talking
rate up.
about your rep range of, like, your 6 to 8. Yeah.
Yeah,
And, like,
even 4 to 6, right? Like, even sometimes going down to that 4 to 6, right? Not every time, but putting on that extra weight and not, like, also don't start at your 4 rep weight. Lots of injuries can happen that way too, right? Like, if you get injured and you have to take a break from lifting, start light again and work back up to getting heavy, right? Like, I think there's also that misconception that I have to go straight to heavy, which just leads to further injuries, which puts you out even longer. So let's go back to lightweights to get back to heavyweights. And so it is anywhere between sort of what I've been told, 4 and 8. With my, like, with legs, I often aim for 4 to 6. And then with upper body, I'm often aiming for 6 to 8. And that might just be, like, the coach is trying to balance out, like, what I was trying to do as a runner, right? Where you may want a little bit of a, like, strong but lighter upper body and really strong engine to propel you down the road.
And one thing for me that I've always talked to people to and said, because I find a lot of people have struggled with mitigating effort, and not to generalize, but I've trained with a lot of women who who struggle to lift heavy enough where they're actually getting it. And to me, and the advice I tell them is those last couple of reps, whether you're doing 4, 12, 10, whatever you're doing for the amount of reps, those last couple shouldn't be very easy. Those ones today should be a bit of a struggle. You should be putting the effort into it. And that to me is a guideline for that's how I know I'm lifting heavy shit from my perspective.
Right.
Is if the last couple are tough.
And so one of the things, actually, now that you say that, that like one of my favorite strength and conditioning coaches said to me was, they'll be tough, but you could do two more, right?
Yes.
Like you could struggle through to do two more so that you're not actually at that critical failure point either.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if, again, when we're focusing on this from a perspective of like the metabolic effects, if you're going to go to the gym and you're short on time, focus on your compound movements. So your squats, deads, bench, like the things where you're getting your most bang for your buck, using the most amount of muscles possible. So those, and also we're not doing this every single day. So as hybrid athletes, we're used to kind of training different systems and different ways all the time anyways, but you don't have to go into the gym lifting heavier every day. We're talking like you're 2 to 4 times a week. So and then with that, the other interesting thing, so in Stacey Sims' new book, they're also finding that along with lifting heavy, the other part of the puzzle is to do high intensity interval training. And by that also I mean short bouts. So, and not every day, but again, you're 2 to 3 times a week. If you have a race on the weekend, then maybe it's just once in that week, but where you are bringing your heart rate up above your 85% max for short periods of time, your 10 to 40 seconds all out efforts. And it doesn't have to be for long, and it doesn't have to be running. So it could be, you could be doing it on any of like your rower, your skier, your bike. Where you're pushing hard, you have a short recovery period, pushing hard, so you're getting your heart rate up. And so what that actually does, and it could be for 10 to 20 minutes, and you do that, you're 2 to 3 times a week. So high intensity, where you're getting into those, like your high 85% heart rate, what you're doing then is you're rushing, so the glucose from your blood is being rushed to the muscle tissue to replenish the glycogen. So now you're affecting the insulin systems, your insulin sensitivity, which again we talked about is affected by your lowering levels of estrogen. And then so it's also again helping your mitochondrial density, which again we talked about also lowers with estrogen. And when you're thinking about the weight that you're gaining, it helps you to burn fat and reduces the effects of that, the belly that you start to get during menopause. So it will actually reduce that because we don't have to store that as much anymore.
For sure. And I think, sort of as a compromise, right, for the person that like really loves to go for the run, just tack on 4 to 5 really hard strides at the beginning and the end of your run, right? Like, right? Like, it also has to be about what you love, right? I think one of the things, that a lot of the research that I've, started to focus on is people leave sport, play, activity, exercise, movement, whatever you want to call it, whatever you do, because it's no longer fun. And so if it's not fun, you're not going to show up the next day. And so we want people, clients, et cetera, to show up the next day. And so if for you, meeting up with your friends to go for a run is really important, preserve that, right? That's really important for your mental health, your physical health overall. But then just tack on these strides. Just do like 4 to 5, 10 to 20 second strides at the beginning and the end, but like actually go hard. It also, just as an aside, will make your running even better because like you have to be efficient. Definitely do it on a hill. Like, if you really want to do like super cheat form work, just go run a hill. Go run a hill really hard. You can't fake it because it feels awful
Running a
and it
hill
doesn't work
slow
if you fake
still
it.
hurts.
Like, the fastest, like slow or fast, the sooner you get to the top, the less it hurts.
So, and this is, it's interesting too, because again, like I live in the world of gym. And so people shoot these things at me all the time from social media. And there's so much misinformation out there, but on social media. And one of the big things now is cortisol. So everything is about cortisol, and everything is, we have to lower our cortisol levels. So the interest, and again, cortisol increases belly fat storage. And so It's interesting because what high intensity actually does is it counteracts the effects of overall cortisol levels. So, because the misinformation again that I'm finding on TikTok and Instagram is that because high intensity interval training is intense, so your stress is elevated during the 10, 20 minutes that you're doing it, people that don't really understand the science think therefore it's bad. But what it's actually doing overall throughout the rest of your day is lowering your total cortisol.
Yeah, totally. And I actually, what I think is even more interesting is that scrolling through TikTok and the anxiety and the cortisol rush that you get from that, that's actually far, far worse than any other cortisol impacts. And the cortisol impacts from exercise are very different, right? That's a very specific stress that you're asking your body to do in a very natural way, right? Like, it's totally natural for your heart rate to go up while you're doing something hard. It's totally natural to feel a little bit stressed when you're trying to do something that's physically challenging. And so bad cortisol is a toxic environment where you feel like you have to be on edge all the time and your heart rate is elevated because you feel like you have to be on the defense. That's bad cortisol, right? Like cortisol, right? Where you get the balance throughout the rest of your day. And if you work in a stressful environment, you really should go get that cortisol hit from exercise in the morning. So you can like level out wherever you're working. But like that cortisol, you know, that you get from exercise is it's expected from the body. In fact, the body craves it so that throughout the rest of the day, your cortisol can actually be at a level that allows you to function, to be productive, to be present with your kids, whatever it is that you're doing. There's so much misinformation about that. It makes me so mad. I don't go on TikTok and Instagram for those reasons.
Oh, tell me. Well, my clients send it to me and I just wring my hair out sometimes. The other interesting thing that I read in Stacey Sims' book was that with the high intensity bouts, again, because you're pushing your system to its max capacities,
Yeah.
that it actually so it increases the strength of your vascular system. So by doing that, then when you're in your day-to-day, so when we talk about how during perimenopause we are less responsive to the changing in temperatures in the environment. So we get hot flashes, we get really cold. So increasing the strength of the vascular system allows you to actually adapt to changing temperatures better. So they find then high intensity interval training does actually reduce hot flashes and it reduces the amount that you feel cold in cold environments and you respond better to the changing environments. So interesting stuff. So yeah, but again, just 1 to 3 times a week for that short bouts. Again, just strides after your runs, intervals on your machines, and then lift heavy. So and then you there's always, of course, there's room for your long runs and your long sessions also. But just balancing it all out. So
Can I just say I love that training plan. I want to do that.
that's kind of how we train, isn't
Yeah,
it?
pretty much. Lift heavy stuff and do sprints. I'm down with that.
But like 200s are my like one fast 150s and all out 200s are like some of my favorite intervals. One of the things that I've always like found really interesting looking at marathon training was they're like speed session 1Ks. I'm like, that's not speed. I'm like, speed is like anywhere between like 50 and 200 meters going as fast as you can. And actually, if you want your marathon to be better, go and like one night a week, every 2 weeks, do intervals that are between 50 and 200 meters all out. No, you're not going to get the distance in, but you can either like manipulate volume or intensity. These are things that you all know. But that hit of intensity is so important for like the longer distance training as well. And then, especially for females, right? Like throughout all these like hormone changes, like to the point of Dr. Stacey Sims's work, like all of that is super crucial. Also, track workouts with your friends are so much fun. So much
Yes, it is. The last question then that we have, which I do find, again, this affects so many women, especially as they age, is sleep. So again, with our lowering estrogen and the hormones and rising cortisol at night quite often as well, a lot of women have a hard time staying asleep, falling asleep, or just constantly waking up. So do you find this, and what do you know?
Okay, so hi, I'm a sleep champion. I have had a little bit of like affected sleep. I think generally speaking, most people have pretty poor sleep hygiene. I'm holding up my phone, right? Most people sleep with their phone beside their bed. I think it's the worst thing that you can do for yourself. There are other alarm clocks that you can buy. There are other ways to take notes. If you're worried about emergencies happening, you can put your phone on ring outside of the room, but not having it beside your bed is huge. Talk about a cortisol, right? Like thinking that it's there. A lot of people get up and they can't sleep, and what do? They scroll. And so all of a sudden your brain turns on and thinks that it's on. Sleep hygiene was always a really big thing in my house growing up. I was always a good sleeper, but I've always read before going to sleep, right? So, and I read fiction. I can't read nonfiction where then my brain goes like, oh, how do I implement this in my life? That's my morning routine. But really setting up a sleep routine that works for you. So for some people, that's having a hot shower. Some people, that's having a cool shower. Some people, that's having a hot bath. Some people, that's watching a TV show with their partner and then getting into bed. But it's this idea of like really disconnecting from your life and setting a routine and trying to stick with it. If you don't have a sleep routine, try and set one up. Try and journal about it as to what works and what doesn't work. I mean, I'm still training quite a bit. So like one of my challenges as a marathon runner is I wake up so hungry in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m. I'm like, So I take a protein supplement at night now that I found really helpful. It's also got magnesium, bisglycinate in it, GABA, one other thing that I can't remember off the top of my head, but like supplements that are known to help with sleep. Again, I drink something, so I drink, I go to bed hydrated, I go to bed with a snack, all good things for me. But it's really like setting that routine. If you have disrupted sleep, and it usually comes in two formats. You wake up with a racing mind, try and put a notebook beside your bed and put those thoughts down and see if you can get yourself back to sleep. Dr. Amy Bender has done some really cool work with sleep in athletes. And so if you're really not falling asleep again after sort of 20 minutes, you got to get up, go to a different place, ideally read a book, don't get on your phone and try and get back to sleep. If you're having trouble going to sleep, it's probably most likely actually like sleep hygiene, but it may actually be like a time to talk to your doctor about like the hormones that you like hormone replacement therapy. But I think first and foremost, it's like really trying a sleep routine. Like 2 to 3 nights is not trying something. Charles Duhigg's habit book, like you have to try something solidly for 3 weeks for it to develop as a habit. You really have to like try something for 3 weeks before you can see if there's actually an effect. Right. I don't know that I actually answered your question. That was quite a broad answer, but I hope that helps people.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. And yeah, again, like you're establishing a calming routine before bed. And even like even if you have to move your dinner time earlier so you're not digesting, like just so your whole system is in a rest and outside of the digest phase. So it's not focusing on that. It's you're just on rest. And I think the screen is probably a big thing too. But again, get your hormones checked because progesterone can have an effect that will help you sleep also. So if that one is plummeting, then it could be that also. So there's so many factors around the sleep. And then there are supplements that help, like you said, that you can also try. So and different types of like calming supplements. I take magnesium before bed, and it helps again with calming and the relaxation phase of muscle. So just you have to find what works for you too. So yes, I appreciate that. We did talk an awful lot about an awful lot. I think we got all of the questions answered.
I do got
Oh
one
no,
more.
Dave's got
I got one
questions. Oh
more. No,
yes.
I got one more. I got one more. This isn't mine. This isn't mine. So, and this is coming from an elite athlete perspective. And you may have touched on a bit of it, so just, but I think maybe we talked about from not so much an elite athlete perspective. But what are the major impacts on your training output? And is there anything you can do as an athlete to support that performance?
For sure. So, I think the biggest change for me has been the intensity of certain workouts. So I used to like clockwork, do workouts Monday, Thursday, Saturday. Monday and Thursday were pretty intense. Saturday was a lot less intense comparatively, but more intense compared to like easy days. And I now sort of primarily focus with two really big, intense days. And then there's sort of like a medium day before the intense day. And then, in a sense, as much rest as I need. And so some of those intense days become really long. I'm a marathoner, right? So just let me preface that around like the specifics of what I'm sharing. So I think it's managing the intensity. If you looked at the metrics from those 2 days, the metrics of the intensity equal what was on those 3 days. And so, in a sense, there's no people are like, well, then you're losing it on training. It's like, no, I'm just making things even harder on those 2 days so that I get the same bouts of intensity, but that I get enough recovery in between those things so I can really go hard again on those intense days. I think the other thing is it's like self-compassion and self-kindness, so that like particularly when I had like achy knees and no muscle firing, right? Giving myself the grace to take the extra rest day so that I could really go hard. And I made the mistake a couple times of trying to go hard when I wasn't quite as recovered as I thought I was. And you actually then sacrifice that workout as opposed to getting that massive intensity hit by waiting another day. You don't get to pick when race day is. That's the hardest part. And there's certain things that, like, everybody has bad race days, right? Those things happen. And I think there's just a few more variables that females have to navigate with a menstrual cycle, you know, across the lifespan compared to males. And it can be really challenging mentally. I think if you know that your hormones affect your mental health a lot, that you've got to set up strategies so that you can go into your races confident. I think I'm going to again use Camille Heron. Camille Heron had her period during Further, right? The 6-day marathon. People say when you have your period, you can't go as hard. I think she just proved wrong. I've had
12 world
races where I've
records
had
later, I think she did okay.
13, just so we're clear,
13.
13 world records. Yeah. I think she did okay. And I think that's a good point to bring up. You know, like it is possible. It's a little bit different, but I think we've also, sort of framed that when you have your period, you can't do certain things. And I think that's wrong. I think M. Pallant, I believe, is her last name. She's a triathlete. She had her period last year during a 70.3. She like smashingly won. And why I bring that up is she posted it on Instagram, like her winning photo, and she had a blood spot. And some guy was like, well, couldn't you have photoshopped that out? And she's like, no, because you know what? This is my life. And I live this every day. And if it makes you uncomfortable, that's you. That's not me, right? This is what 50% of the population deals with. And I'm racing for like 4.5 hours. Like, I'm not stopping to change my tampon because day one is heavy. I'm in the middle of a race and my goal is to win. I don't care about the other stuff, right? And removing the stigma from that. And but also to say that you can do hard things when you have your period, right? I think Whoop and Aura and some of those activity trackers have done a disservice to women to say, you have your period, take it easy. And sometimes, like, listen, I've had cramps where I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't go to the workout right now. I got to sort this out before I can actually like go smash this. But for the most part, you can show up. I think the Lancet last week did a disservice to women by saying that hormones do not affect mood and that most women do not have anxiety because of their hormone fluctuations. We may not have clinical anxiety and clinical depression. We absolutely know that there is a link between hormones and mental health and mental performance. And so you need to figure out like what are your strengths as an athlete and what are your weaknesses? And if your hormones affect your mental health, not clinically, but enough that on race day you don't show up feeling confident, you've got to figure out strategies so that you can trust yourself to show up and be the best version of yourself on that day, period or not, perimenopause symptoms or not, so that like you can go and smash it the way you've been doing it in practice on race day. And like going to the limit, sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it isn't, but going in with the mindset that that's just kind of like the luck of the draw with racing, as opposed to that's the luck of the draw of my hormones and this reframing and reshifting of how we think about things. Did I answer your question, Dave?
Probably.
And
Yeah, I think that's all.
I would
Excellent.
say,
That's excellent.
you know, like as a, you know, I really appreciate you, Dave, sitting here. And I know you maybe didn't get to ask as many questions as you want. And this is like very new territory, and a lot of people are starting to talk about it. And I thank you for doing that. And it's about supporting us. I think for a long time, part of the reason we didn't talk about perimenopause was a lot of people said, like, that's not a thing. And I think a lot of men said that that was not a thing. I think one of the things I'd love to see kids in particular learn is how to come to a coach with an injury without complaining. Hey, my Achilles is hurting. I don't think I should put spikes on today. I'd like to do this instead. And I think, you know, how we come to it, like, I think as a partner, like when Raul's not here, but like, I know I can be super whiny and be like, oh, this is so hard. And as a partner, it's really hard for you as well, because it's almost like we need an outlet to share the things that we're going through, but it sounds like complaining. And in a way, we need a space to a safe space to complain about the challenges that we're going through, because we look at guys beside us and we're like, it's just so easy. And there's this like jealousy. And so thank you for letting us kind of voice our opinions this way. But I think it's also really important that we as women, when we start to talk about things, that we do it in a way that, how do I say this? Not that it's professional, but it's going to make people feel uncomfortable. But I want it to make people feel uncomfortable in a way that they want to lean in and help me, as opposed to lean away and be afraid. And so, hey, I'm just struggling today. Like, you know, it's really hard to do this lift. I've got really bad cramps. Could we think about, you know, eccentrically loading my quads in a different way, right? And all of a sudden, if I said it to you like that, it's like, yeah, absolutely happy to help you, as opposed to like, I just can't do this. It almost shuts down the conversation. And so I'm not victim blaming or victim shaming. I'm just asking women to advocate for themselves so that, you know, men want to lean in. And I'm asking guys to ask those questions like, hey, how are you doing? Like, do you need to like shift your workout a bit? Like, hilariously, like my boobs used to get really sore during perimenopause, so I couldn't bench press, right? Like, if it would cut, I was like, ah, no, right? But I could bench press with like separate, like with two
Dumbbells.
dumbbells as opposed to, right? And so it was like
Dumbbells are
just
better, anyone.
shifting. I know, but there's just something so satisfying about like plates on either side. I'm like,
Looks
anyways,
cool. It looks cool.
it look. I'm also lifting alone in my friend's gym, like nobody's seeing it. But, you know, it's this idea of like men leaning in and women advocating for themselves in a way that like we can meet in the middle and work together and find common ground, as opposed to feeling like we're polarized to each other.
Awesome. I'm good.
Thanks. I know I went too long.
No, I think that was fantastic, actually. It's probably a good way to end things off. So, thanks so much, Sasha, for coming on. It was definitely a topic I was looking forward to discussing. And because the reality is all women are going to go through this, whether we like it or not. And the more we can talk about it and learn from each other, the less people will suffer through it. And like you said, just be able to have more open conversation and you know, thrive through it still. So thank you so much for sharing with our listeners everything that you've gone through and all your knowledge around it as well. So we appreciate
Thanks
it.
for having me. No, I appreciate you guys.
Right. Take care.